Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. This month, I moderated another Good Food Gathering town hall meeting, this time at the Netivot Shalom congregation in Pikesville. We discussed acting well and explored how congregations and individuals can affect systemic change in our food system. Joining us were Dr. Serena Jordan, who conducts wellness classes at Huber Memorial Church and is the author of the book, The Seven Disciplines of Wellness. Abby Zuckerberg, who organized a faith garden and compost project at the Netivot Shalom congregation. Robbie Rawl, who is executive director of Sugar Free Kids, an organization that encourages congregations to engage in political actions that improve the health of our children. And Michael J. Wilson, who is executive director of Maryland Hunger Solutions. This town hall meeting was sponsored by the Center for Livable Futures Food and Faith Project, Interfaith Power and Light, and the Mark Steiner Show. And here's that conversation. So I thought we did very quickly just go down the line and let people kind of introduce themselves and a bit about what it is they do inside their world, just to kind of lay the framework. And then we'll try to tie these, link these together. So we start with Dr. Serena Jordan.
Thank you, Mrs. Steiner, and thank you for the invitation. There are two things that happened in different parts of the country that made what we are doing at Huber Memorial possible. Out of the vision of Pastor P.M. Smith of Huber Memorial came a mission statement that was that basically rescue the children, redeem the family, and recreate community. And the theme of it is that it's all about relationship, or it's not about anything at all. You see, our vertical relationship with God impacts all of our horizontal relationships. So that's what happened on one end of the country. And then the second effort was my research and development of focus groups, support groups, consulting, teaching about healthy living. I used my experience in education in holistic nutrition, my spiritual foundation as a student of the Bible and a minister's daughter, and countless hours in the public and community health space to help bring about the change in the lives of the at-risk populations. I also had firsthand experience with this from my own life-threatening illness and from my wonderful husband, who was a 17-year cancer survivor, and he was here, but I don't see him at this
point.
Right in the
back.
Oh, there he is.
Very effective.
That's my official poster man. The conclusion that I came to at that point was that it's all about relationship. So I wrote the book, The Seven Disciplines of Wellness, and in a plain English set of chunks, what God had said through Scripture about how to live and stay well. Huber understands the relationship piece, and what it needed was to discover what does that mean in the context of being well and acting well, body and spirit, mind, body and spirit. So we see that the motivating factor for sustaining healthy lifestyle change is rooted in an individual's personal relationship with God and for us by following Jesus Christ. Three years ago, my husband and I became a part of that Christian education department at Huber and taught our first 8-week wellness Bible study. To date, 20% of the membership, including 50% of the food services ministry, has taken the class. We study the Bible, but we also give practical application as to how to participate, how the participants can actually see themselves as candidates for change. Examples of the practical application include at the end of each of the 8-week class, they all leave with a little baggie of something healthy, some baked good or something. We have field trips that we went to the health food store or a flea market and also a plant-based restaurant just to give them a practical application. And then at the 8th week, we do a food demo that has a healthy plant-based meal celebration. The other thing we did was we actually went out and at Lake Montebello, we had a exercise and tailgate. And the tailgate was very healthy, whole grain kind of foods and plant-based. So the faith-based community should be the healthiest community is what we feel. And not because we are better than others, because we're not, but it's because of our faith and our relationship with the Father that equips us to address the health of the mind, body, and spirit. So Huber Church, as a result, will soon be known as the healthiest people on the hill at York Road.
And next to her is Robbie Rawl, from Executive Director of Sugar Free Kids Maryland.
Hello, thank you. I'm happy to be here. Thank you. I'm Executive Director of Sugar Free Kids, which is a new coalition here in Maryland, statewide coalition, just launched in February. And our goal is to reverse the epidemics of childhood obesity and type 2 diabetes here in this state. Many people are really unaware of how widespread the problem is of childhood obesity here. Maryland, although it's one of the more wealthier states, one of the better educated states, has many more resources, you think that our you know, health determinants would maybe fare better than the rest of the country, and that's not the case. Just like the rest of the country, one in three children is overweight or obese, and we're starting to see, as a result, that children as young as 10 years old now are experiencing chronic illnesses such as heart disease, high blood pressure, metabolic syndrome, and are at much higher risk for various forms of cancer, asthma, and diabetes, and depression, excuse me. Diabetes, type 2 diabetes, we can't even call it. We used to call it adult onset diabetes, because these were diseases that we didn't see in adults until they were at least 60 years old, and we're seeing it in 10-year-olds. And being a chronic illness, it gets worse and worse and worse. And what it comes down to, if we don't do anything to reverse these trends, this generation of children may live shorter lives than their parents, for the first time in history. This is something we could always count on, was at least our children living longer, healthier lives than us. And we're being faced with a situation that this may not be the case. So Sugar Free Kids was founded by MedCHI, the State Medical Society, also NAACP, American Heart Association, and the Horizon Foundation, which is a health and wellness foundation here in Howard County. And our goals are to reverse this trend. So, of course, we know many, many things contribute to childhood obesity, and obesity in general. You know, physical activity, nutrition, unsafe neighborhoods where kids can't go outside to play. So the question really was, what do we focus on to make the most impact? And we reached out to experts all across the country, and what they all said is, one, focus on children. You know, we know that very young children, we're talking about 5 years old and younger, really that's the time when habits are formed, healthy eating habits, habits of physical activity, and so forth. Focus there. You know, children still have the opportunity to change their habits and create healthier norms. And also to focus on nutrition. So Americans as a whole are exercising more than ever, contrary to popular belief. However, our obesity rates have tripled since the 1970s. So something else here is going on. And it's not just nutrition as a whole. The Institute of Medicine released a report in 2012 that confirms a lot of the research going on, that the number one contributor to the obesity epidemic are actually sugary drinks, drinks with sugar added. And that alone contributes to 20% of the obesity epidemic. So it's not that the other factors are unimportant. There's so many things that need to be affected. But we thought, as a coalition, we're going to focus on this, make the biggest difference, and work on making the healthy choice the easy choice in the places that our kids live, learn, and play, and promote healthier beverage choices. We're at the stage now where, you know, children who were born after 2000, all right, now we're in 2014, so they're teenagers now. One in three can count on developing diabetes. And we talk about African-American and Latino populations. One in two, 50% of the population, can count on developing type 2 diabetes during their lifetimes. So this is an area we're focusing on with I'm sure we'll address this later, with education and outreach, but ultimately making legislative change at the state level.
Thank you. Michael Wilson, Maryland Hunger Solutions.
Thank you, Mark. Maryland Hunger Solutions is a statewide organization, and we have a very simple goal, which is to eliminate hunger in the state of Maryland. It's a tough challenge, but we're up to doing it, and we know we can't do it alone, so we do it through advocacy, through outreach, and through education. So Maryland, as my colleague said, is literally, according to per capita income, the wealthiest state in the country. And you would think a state that is so wealthy would not have hunger. The truth is there's lots of hunger in Maryland. For example, there are 786,000 people in the state of Maryland who utilize food stamps because they are so poor that they need additional assistance. In the city of Baltimore, there are 207,000 folks on food stamps. In Baltimore County, 108,000. So many of your neighbors, you may not recognize or know that they have hunger. But if you look in the refrigerator, they may have cold air and cold water. And so there is also a clear correlation between hunger and nutrition and all of the other issues that we've talked about. And so our goal is to try to deal with hunger in a number of ways. So there are existing programs to address hunger. The food stamp program is one of them. We actually pre-screen and sign people up for food stamps when they're eligible. We teach other nonprofit groups to do the same. We work with the school nutrition programs, whether it's school breakfast, school lunch, after-school meals, and summer meals. And we can talk about their connection both to kids and education and nutrition and obesity over the course of this session. And one example I'll give you is that we all know that when kids stop going to school in the summer, there's a learning gap. There's a documented learning gap when they're no longer reading and writing and doing arithmetic on a regular basis. And so there's been a key effort to try to have kids read more and write more and do more academic work over the summer. There's also a nutrition gap. So if you're a kid who gets free lunch and free breakfast and an after-school meal at school and school ends, your need for those meals does not end. And so having a summer meal and having summer meals available to kids, particularly low-income kids, is critical, not just to deal with the academic gap, but to deal with the nutrition gap that they're also facing. We also work with WIC, and we work with seniors as well, who also utilize food stamps at a high level. So there are a lot of existing programs that are out there to help people deal with these issues that are federal programs, that are state programs. We want to encourage folks to utilize them to the most of their ability because that's one of the ways we're going to address hunger in the state of Maryland.
Abby Zuckerberg, who runs the Faith Garden here at Netivot Shalom.
So I'd like to welcome everyone, first of all. I'm so glad that you're all here. It's exciting to have something different in our walls. So I want to tell you a little bit about our congregation. We're a very young congregation. We're only about 10 years old, and we are a very small community. Community is our – if we did not have community, we wouldn't function around here. We all depend on one another. And so when we were given the opportunity to create a garden in the backyard, we were very excited because there was a grant provided by the Pearlstone community, what's it called, Kayam Farm. They had money available for us. And so we started very small, and we came up with this concept that we would have a kiddish garden. And a kiddish garden, the word kiddish is what the prayer that we make over the wine at the end of services every Saturday morning, and it has another meaning, which is to make something holy. And so we thought that we would create a garden where we could grow food to provide to the community at our kiddush, and then also to do a holy act of giving the extra food to people who need it. And so that's basically what the goal of the kiddush garden is to provide food to ourselves and then also to give to others. And along the way, we're also doing some pretty important things, educating the community about sustainability, sort of byproducts. These are all very Jewish concepts, although there is no particular green tractate in the Talmud. There are some concepts in Judaism, one of which is called Bal Tashchit, which means that you shouldn't be destructive. And the concept is that, you know, the original concept was that during times of war, you shouldn't be knocking down fruit trees and things just for the sake of knocking things down, because these are the things that sustain us. And we draw from that. And then another concept, general concept in Judaism, is called tikkun olam, which is repair of the world. And composting, in particular, is a way in which we take something that has become sort of profane, which is our scraps, and in the process of composting, it becomes something holy again, something that will sustain us. And so this is really a good example of tikkun olam and baal tashchit, where we are not wasting anything and we are rebuilding the world at the same time. The other thing that we really are very proud about is that our kids are in the backyard. You can see in our backyard, we have lots of space. Our kids are in the backyard running around next to a compost pile and next to a garden. And if they've never been exposed to any of this before, just by osmosis, they sort of are. And so we're really excited that that Food and Faith Grant has continued to support us, because we're in our fourth year. And we hope to continue to move forward and grow and continue to give our extra food to Ahavas Yisrael, which is the Jewish charity that we provide the extra food on Thursday nights. They pack up baskets to families who are in need and don't have enough food for Friday night. So this summer we hope we will have a very big bounty to give to them.
So there are a couple of themes here that seem to connect. Let me start with this. I mean, and we are here talking about this good food gathering as part of the Food and Faith Project. And there have been a lot of different faiths represented on this panel over the course of the last four conversations that we've had. And I was thinking about what you were saying just a moment ago about that we should be destructive in repair of the world, and how that fits into what you were talking about earlier, Serena Jordan, about spiritual relationships and playing together. So I think that one of the things we don't think about, just in terms of the policy questions, in terms of how we approach the idea of keeping healthy and creating a different way of getting our food and what we eat and how we approach it, is we don't think about churches, synagogues, mosques, temples of any kind, of being the center of that, right? Very separate. And because I think in some ways Baltimore, like every other city, is very separate cities. We talk among ourselves in our silos, because we all live in our silos. And that can be a good thing at times, it can be a dangerous thing at times when it's dangerous, but we don't kind of share what we have. So I'm curious what you think, in a larger scale, before we come back to the specific things that you're doing, about the role you think that faith communities can play in addressing these issues of hunger, of what our young people eat, of what we eat. Is there a way that they can interplay together, even if they're in very different worlds and worship in very different ways? How do you think that fits together? You know, I mean, you're on the cusp, both your congregations actually are represented here, thinking about this, are on the cusp of very multicultural neighborhoods here in Pikesville, York Road, you know. So how do you think that all fits together? Go ahead, Serena, you can begin.
One of the things that I think would be most effective is to raise a level of consciousness about food, about the food supply, about stewardship, and about not being destructive, about what it means to have outreach or to support different charities. And so once we get to that point, then we can begin to then make demands on the food supply and hold them more accountable for what condition the food supply actually is in. So, for example, every time, if you are a member of a grocery store, you have the little thing they swipe and you get a little discount. So every time we use that, and we use that for some denatured food or for some food that's not healthy, it's like a vote that says, it's okay, you guys keep doing what you're doing, we'll eat it anyway. And so once we can, as congregation and as a faith community, can start
raising that level of consciousness and saying, no, those foods aren't acceptable, we're not buying them, and this is what we expect, then I think overall it'll have an impact on, you know, the quality of food and the overall health condition of civilization.
Yeah, because although I was thinking about what you were saying, that all of our traditions have ways of eating that aren't necessarily healthy.
That's exactly right.
I can remember growing up with my grandparents here in Baltimore, who lived on Park Heights, off of Park Heights, my bubby and grandpa, and I ate the food, but looking back on it, what we ate was full of fat and all this stuff that was just tons of it in everything we ate, and I can still see these kind of jars of chicken fat that were just all over the place in my grandparents' kitchen. So, I mean, I think about, you know, what we were consuming, and it really is important. When I think about the garden you have here at Netivot Shalom, and how that can begin to change kind of a consciousness, as you were saying, just by osmosis almost, of what kids can start thinking as they get older.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, we have here probably the healthiest kiddish in town. I think I told you that.
You have to stop and explain what that means, because after a lot of services, kiddish can be cakes.
Kiddish can be
little cake, whiskey, little this, little that, right?
Chopped liver, and, you know, all kinds of things that aren't really
sodas.
Very healthy. But we do. We're really proud that actually we make a salad and it's the first thing gone from the table. But also, the other thing I was thinking about as we were having this discussion was that where else to take responsibility to start to be a starting point where you take responsibility for your brother than in a faith community? I mean, we all depend on one another within our walls, and I think that that's the only way that change happens is when we start to realize that we don't live in a silo and that we have to take responsibility for one another and for community. So that's why I think that this is another layer of importance to this project.
Michael, go ahead.
Yeah, I want to take a little issue here. I mean, because we're not obviously not a faith organization, but we understand the importance of faith. And so, in the debate about the Farm Bill, when there were some who wanted to drastically cut the amount of food stamps that were available to poor people in this country, we realized there was not a statewide voice about faith in Maryland. And we reached out, and Brooke, who's here with us today, led this effort. We have more than 100 houses of worship, many different denominations, very ecumenical, who signed a letter to the Congress saying, do not cut food stamps. So it was the first time we had done it, so we thought 100 was a good start. Yeah. But we'd like to make that a bigger faith voice in the discussion about hunger and nutrition in the state and in the country. There's a debate right now in the Congress about the kind of standards they're going to have for school lunches. And there's an effort to undo what's been done. Recommendations by the Institute of Medicine to have healthier lunches for kids, to make sure that all the grains are whole grains, that there are additional fruit and vegetable servings, and that fruit juice will not count as fruit, that you actually have to have fruit and vegetables. And there's an effort in the Congress to undo that. And so we are, you know, leading the effort against that, and we're going to work on another faith letter to have folks say this is not the way we should have healthy foods. And the last example I'd give is, you know, because we work so much in the space of food stamps, Maryland Hunger Solutions, even prior to the time I got there, led the effort to have bonus bucks so that food stamp recipients could go to their local farmers market and not only buy fresh fruits and vegetables, but got a bonus and could spend additional dollars at the farmers markets. So that's good for their families. It's good for their stretching their dollars. And it's good for the local farmers markets who need that kind of revenue here in the state of Maryland. So there are a lot of cross currents that are going on here, even outside of the basic faith community.
Yeah, probably, please.
Yeah. You know, I'm not sure how much you're all aware that the powerful voice that faith communities have had in public health efforts. I mean, you know, Michael just, you know, highlighted a few, but here in Maryland even, passage of the Firearm Safety Act last year, which was a gun violence prevention measure, the faith community really banded together in support of that. working on, you know, tobacco control legislation and raising tobacco taxes that resulted in Medicaid expansion, that expanded Medicaid in Maryland to hundreds of thousands of new people. Decision makers in the state are well aware that the faith community is the pulse of the people, that it's a large community, it's a strong community, and it's a very, you know, connected to the voice of the community. So that's certainly a way, you know.
You're listening to last week's Good Food Gathering Town Hall meeting that took place at the Netivot Shalom congregation in Pikesville, where we explored acting well and the ways we can affect systemic change in our food system. We have to take a very brief break, but don't go away. There's more of this conversation coming right up after this break. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and this hour we're listening to this month's Good Food Gathering Town Hall meeting at the Netivot Shalom congregation in Pikesville, where we explored acting well and the ways we can affect the food system on a systemic level. Here's the rest of that congregation.
So I'm wondering, in some ways, I was just to hit another tone, a note for a minute and kind of tie this back in a little while together again, is that we had a program the other week on our show with people from who lived in Park Heights, below Northern Parkway and above Park Circle. And what they did in that community, which I found was really fascinating, is that unlike a lot of other gardens I've seen that were started around the country in poor neighborhoods, which are still trying to figure out how to sell to restaurants and other places and build a farm, that this was a garden that was, maybe think this was the garden you have out back here at Netivot Shalom, that the garden they had wasn't a profit-making garden. It was a garden that was created for the community. They sold chairs in CSA that could be done with SNAP, that were affordable to people from $50 to $15 a month, and healthy food, and then showing people not just also how to cook the food, how to store food for the winter. And it's I thought about this as something really unique, in some ways very revolutionary in terms of an approach to how we begin to kind of use faith-based institutions to kind of change the nature of what communities do. You know, and I think that when you talked about what you do with your garden, whether it's here for Kiddush after the service, or whether it's giving food to families in the Jewish community who are in need, I mean, those are the beginnings of changing things, I think. So I'm curious how you all think that might be expanded. How do you think those ideas can kind of fill a city in a metropolitan area beyond just these small communities? What roles do churches and synagogues have to play in that? How could that happen? We have thousands of empty lots here around Baltimore County and Baltimore City. What's the vision of how we might be able to change some of that? What role do places of worship play in that?
Well, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could network? I mean, we're all sort of working independently right now, and wouldn't it just be marvelous if we could somehow become a coalition, and then the strength, because I know that one of the things that we struggle with here is manpower and commitment, and you know, a garden is not an easy thing to keep going, and you know, if we had some sort of coalition and sharing of knowledge, then we could go all the further.
Everybody just jump in, please.
Well, at Huber, Serena, we have a community garden, and we are excited about it. And what we've done is basically ask, we have several ministries at the church, so we're inviting different ministries to come and take a Saturday in order to work the garden. We're also spinning it a little bit by saying, you know, it's very therapeutic, and it relieves stress, because we're taking this whole holistic approach, you know, being close to nature. And we have the seniors, a lot of them are from the South, and so they grew up, you know, in gardens. And then you have the little kids who are also, we're wanting to get them involved. And then you have the high school teenagers kind of crowd that need community service hours. And so between all that, you know, we could come up with some more of a workforce that you wouldn't normally have available. So we're doing all that. And then on Sunday mornings, we actually bring in some of the harvest to show. And I remember one Sunday there was a melon or something that was just so beautiful and great. And so, I mean, not during service, they didn't start bidding for it, but you could see that they were actually excited about it. And so the garden is organic. And so we play that up as well. Oh, wouldn't it be nice? And so every week we actually send out this mailer. It's a constant contact kind of thing where we have a list and we actually invite people to come into the garden and we tell them what time. So now that it's getting hotter, we come out earlier and we're done before noon. And so we kind of get them involved that way. And then we have a share ministry that we give the harvest, the extra to. So there's lots of ways. And so just getting that awareness out. So then, among the leadership, then this leadership talks to another leadership at another church, and no one wants to be left out. So then you have someone else who's somewhat curious about a community garden also. So at some point, it may not be the way we want it to happen, but it could just become in vogue that you have a church garden attached to your property. So whatever the reason, it still could happen that way.
I think that that's a kind of a bottom-up change, and we also kind of looking at the larger picture. I was thinking about we're all concerned about our children, and every congregation is concerned about their children and what happens to their children, and you would hope also to other people's children. And so I think when we talk, let's say, about the connection between, to me, there's a connection here between. Hungry Free Maryland, that you talk about all the time, Rick Wilson, and the Sugar Free Maryland, they're not disconnected.
No.
Because a lot of hungry kids are not sugar free.
Right.
And we look at a lot of young kids who are obese and having these medical issues, and they are very heavy, but they don't eat well.
Right.
And they're poor.
Right.
And there's a real connection here between that, and also not separate from what we may feed people and feed ourselves and our children after you leave service afterwards.
Right.
I mean, all those things are not separate.
Right. So, people who eat an all ramen noodle diet aren't doing that because that's what they like.
Right.
They're doing that because that's what they have to do. And the biggest connector here is poverty. If you don't have money to make choices, then you don't get choices. And I know one of the things, and I think you may know about this, Rami, there was a study about a program called Summer EBT, so that folks who had kids who were out of school for the summer got additional SNAP dollars on their card. So they got extra money for the summer for the kids. And the data show that there was less obesity, there were less sugary products, there were more fruits and vegetables, and they ate healthier. So lo and behold, if you give people more resources, they can make better choices. And the other example I always use about poverty is, people who have a dietitian and a cook generally are doing okay. How many of you have a dietitian and a cook? I'll tell you who does. Everybody who has a kid in schools. Because schools have dietitians and cooks. And our challenge is to make sure that the schools do as good a job as possible, because they feed more kids in the schools in Maryland than all the fast food restaurants together. I mean, they feed hundreds of thousands of kids every day. And our challenge is to make those meals as healthy as possible. And the one pitch I'd make here is the Baltimore City Schools have a new CEO, started on the 1st of July, Dr. Gregory Thornton. And he has an opportunity to remake what they've been able to do and affect the lives of hundreds of thousands of kids for a long time if he will take the charge and really make that happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Michael highlighted a lot of the challenges here. I mean, when 2 liters of soda cost 99 cents, right, and an equivalent of milk, a half gallon of milk is roughly 2 liters, cost almost $3. If you're on a limited income, you don't have a choice in that matter. And everybody wants to do right by their children. Everybody wants healthy, strong children. So this is where, when we're on that ground level, yes, a lot of it is certainly in congregations when we have meetings, when we have potlucks, if we have a preschool, we decide what drinks get served there, right? We can impact that choice very easily. you know, what things are offered in our vending machines and so on. But sometimes we do need to try and help it along by making policy changes that truly make the healthy choice easier. So we worked on a healthy child care bill that we were able to pass in the Maryland General Assembly a couple of months ago, which again ensures that children who are in child care settings, you know, one of the places they spend most of their day, are provided with healthy beverages. And these are ways that we can assist. You know, individuals have a responsibility to you know, choose healthy things for their families, and education is a big part of that. But policy change is a way that we can certainly help make the healthy choice the easy choice.
I mean, a couple of things we were talking about here, I'll just throw this number out because we talk about our school system, what they can do.
Right.
The collective expenditure for our public schools in the state of Maryland for food, the collective expenditure is close to $1 billion.
Right.
You combine all the counties in Baltimore City together, $1 billion.
Right.
That carries a huge, that's a hefty amount of money that could, A, affect the food system, who buys what and where it's from, affect industry, because that's what we're talking about, is how to affect that, right?
Right.
And money does affect it. I mean, if you talk about what you want with sugar-free kids and hunger and what our kids do, I think that has to be, we have to take into account, because every day our kids are the temptation of sweets is in our face. I mean, biologically, we want sweets for a reason. We went around and looked for fruit. We wanted to eat the fruit because it was sweet, but you had to go after it. Now it's in your face 24/7. And so, and our kids are battling with this, and so in some ways, what we're talking about here is you are battling commercial interests that are knowingly or unknowingly...
Knowingly.
...addicting our children.
Knowingly.
Right? So, and we have a role to play in that. Whether it's $1 billion in the school system or what happens out of our communities of faith, so I mean, let's wrestle with that. How do you do that? I mean, it's a huge industry. Every time you try to do something, they have lobbyists to make more than probably than any of us here can even imagine. They spend millions of dollars in lobbying in Annapolis, in Washington, every year to combat the idea that should change.
You know, pricing incentives are a way that can really support families as well. That's a tool that other states and other countries have looked at as well. Right now, it's simply a lot cheaper to buy a sugary drink. And you know, I'm not just talking about sodas, but also the Gatorades, those fake juices like the Capri Suns and those and the flavored waters. They're simply a lot cheaper than the healthy option. So if maybe that were reversed and the healthy option was much more affordable, it would make it a lot easier for people to have access to those things. It would shift things along.
You're absolutely right. In addition to that, the healthier choices are not necessarily available. Mm-hmm. So they're not even there for them to even consider. Maybe I won't buy five, maybe I'll buy two of these healthier versions because they're not there. And you all have probably heard about food deserts, which are areas in the metropolitan area and within the city that don't have access to healthy foods. Within a mile or so, and Hopkins has a very good map of where those areas are. So one of the things I think that has to happen is that we as congregations need to understand that we have a responsibility to be a part of that public policy decision, and we can do it collectively as a block for our individual congregations or whatever, but that we do in fact need a voice. In 2010, I chaired the Maryland Childhood Obesity Task Force that was legislated by the Maryland legislature, and we made recommendations about what we felt needed to take place for childhood obesity, and one of them was sugar-sweetened beverages, and there were some other things. But the bottom line is children typically do not buy their food. And children typically don't make choices about food except whatever is put in front of them. So to say childhood obesity, you have to back up a minute and say, you know, family food matters or family obesity or obesity in general, and then you can trickle down to the children. So that is something that's interesting. And one of the things that I've realized working with various congregations is that we don't always make the connection between our health and the fork.
And so when you have that, then it's very easy then for lobbyists or whomever to continue to do what they do, because we're not necessarily as conscious as we need to be that every time we, you know, go to the store, every time we see something, that some public policy is behind this or someone has said keep on doing it and it's very lucrative. And you're right, sugar is cheap, fat is cheap, all those things, but they also taste good and they're also addictive. Sugar, it's been documented that white sugar is not a food. But we need to understand that.
Right.
It's been totally stripped. It has nothing but calories and has this thing that it does to our brain to make us feel like we are definitely feeling great. But from a nutritional standpoint, our cells are starving and screaming and saying, what are we supposed to do with this? And if we started making... if we just start helping everyone understand that relationship between the food and what we're, how we're feeling and what we're doing, and this whole social economic model, if you look at it, that is self-perpetuating. If you look at it, then, you know, the bad food helps the medical industry do what they do. There are a lot of for-profit entities that shouldn't be for-profit if you really thought about it as far as humankind and our well-being. So everyone is going to have to take a step back, in my opinion, and bite the bullet and suffer a little bit, because to change, to shift the paradigm into a more wellness culture, we're going to have to change a lot of what we do and a lot of what we think. And it is going to take public policy, and someone's going to lose, but in the long run, we're all going to win.
Actually, the interesting thing about this, you know, there's a lot of parallels here, I want to say, to the tobacco movement. With sugar-free kids, we say where the tobacco movement was in 1965. So in 1964, the Surgeon General released his report talking about the dangers of tobacco and what it does to your body. The research was clear. In 1965, half the country was still smoking, right? You know, and here we are 50 years out, and we've made a lot of progress. All the research is there. It's clear about the harm that sugar does to our bodies. It highlights the same centers of your brain as cocaine. But now we're at the stage of education and awareness, you know, getting the word out. We've all been indoctrinated that it's calories in and calories out, and all calories are equal. And it's this individual fault that if you're obese or if you have diabetes, you know, you just didn't go to the gym enough. And that's not true. We are just ingesting far more calories than we can possibly deal with. Not all calories are equal. Any mother could tell you that. Otherwise, we'd all eat ice cream for dinner every night. and some of these foods, the sugar, you know, it's liquid candy. It's purely empty calories. So it's focusing on what we can do to nourish our bodies, what supports we can put into place for our communities. And we're all in a place to make these healthy decisions. Again, you know, children are not doing their own grocery shopping. And the primary thing we can do to make sure that children are healthy is really focusing on what's provided to them, the options provided to them, and the places that they live and learn and play.
I mean, to push back a little bit on that, and I'm going to come out here to the audience, see what people think and what they want to add to this conversation, is that the responses from a lot of people, they don't want food Nazis in their life. They don't want people overloading and telling them what they should and what they shouldn't eat. You saw what happened in New York City when they wanted to ban the large-sized Cokes, and so when Bloomberg wanted to do that, and that was, I remember I was... I ran a mayoral debate here in Baltimore during the last mayoral election, and one of the candidates said, I think we should put an extra tax on sodas, candy, and potato chips. Mm-hmm. And this was done in a church where this debate was taking place, and the people in the church went crazy, screaming and yelling and booing, and we don't need another tax, don't tell us what to eat. And, you know, so it's because you are up against that. I mean, this is the culture. I mean, when you look at TV and it's time to watch a football game or watch a basketball game, or if you're watching the World Cup, it's all beer commercials, it's chip commercials, it's, you know, tortillas and dip and, you know, and I like those things too. I'm not, you know, a purist, but that's what you're up against. I mean, that's the other part besides the commercial interests.
Right.
It's just where people are in the world today and what they want and feel like you are imposing your will on what you think they should be doing.
Sure. Here it's about providing healthy choices. Because as you both pointed out, it's so easy to find the junk. It's very hard to find the healthy. So it's about truly making the healthy choice the easy choice. And right now it's, you know, for example, the beverage industry, and this is where there's a distinct difference with tobacco. The tobacco companies had nothing healthy to offer. You know, Big Soda, Coca-Cola, Pepsi, they have many, many, many healthy products. Mm-hmm. You have probably not heard of most of them. They spend most of their marketing dollars, of course, on the full sugar drinks. But this is why we've created a tool called the Better Beverage Finder, betterbeveragefinder.org, where there's 300 healthier choices that are all created by, you know, these same companies. So we have challenged Coke, actually, to flip their marketing dollars. The amount of money that they spend on their full-calorie drinks, to spend that instead on their healthy drinks, think of the profit margin. Everybody's becoming more health-conscious. Soda consumption has dropped. This is a great opportunity for them to take advantage of this and market their healthier beverages that they already have.
Which is why they have those organizations now, those entities for healthier beverages, because they see it coming. And so they wanted to get in on it before, you know, someone else did. So I actually watched them acquire these little health food entities that made healthy drinks, like I can't even think
Honest
of
Honest Tea is one Honest of them. Tea. That's a local one.
And there's the Naked. All of those were, you know, came out of little farms and little small business kind of organizations, and they've just scooped them all up. They're keeping them under, but they've got them. And that's exactly
and
right.
And we so encourage this is good them to profit to off of the good stuff.
Yes.
So this is the marketing that we've talked about, that they're talking about, which is so clear. If you ever watch television or you look at a magazine, we do some work with some folks in Prince George's County, the Prince George's County Food Equity Council, and they've done a map where they've shown where there are so many more fast food restaurants in the county just inside the Beltway as opposed to just outside the Beltway. The marketing that companies can do in terms of looking at the market and looking at you and your family and your spending habits will dwarf anything that all of us can do. And so the opportunity to do real education about people's ability to be able to make good choices and to be able to make any kind of a choice is a big challenge in the market.
So I'm curious what our audience thinks and get some of you all in this conversation.
We have a whole community of people who are super popular that a lot of young people especially look up to and want to imitate and would like to be around. They're the basketball players, the baseball players, the football players, the soccer players even in World Cup season. And many of them come from relatively poor backgrounds, and because of their native talent and discipline, they're able to work themselves up to where they can compete on a world-class level. But you can't compete on a world-class level unless you're in full condition. You've got really good nutrition. I am sure the Ravens and the Orioles and so on have dietitians, and they have diets. Now, they have to eat a lot more in the way of calories. Like Michael Phelps, 5,000 calories for breakfast, and he swims it off. But that's in proportion. And the thing is, there's this group of people who are around who really ought to be drawn in, dragged in order to attract people, attract students. They are multimillionaires who work for a living, but they can give back very directly to their own communities from where they grew up, other communities that are like them that are around here. So it's something that really might be done. And the management of those players would also recognize doing good for the children means you'll have them growing up and they'll attend the games, they'll buy the tickets and so on. Anyway.
Your thoughts?
So, Michael? So I have two thoughts. One, I agree. I think the challenge is many of these same athletes often have contracts with many of these commercial interests for one reason or another, because they're not making enough money playing ball. They want to make more money doing other things. And I don't want to cast aspersions in generally. I think a lot of them would have like to have an opportunity to do some good things. And one of the things that we did earlier this year, and Mark knew about this, was we did a thing called the Hear the Maryland Crunch. So on Maryland Day, March 25th, our goal is to have every kid in every school all around the state of Maryland begin the day with a bite of an apple. To hear the crunch and to hear it all across Maryland. So we didn't get every kid, but we got 162,000 folks around the state to do it. And we're going to do it again. And I would love to have some of these same athletes join us in that campaign. The message here is very simple. Every kid in Maryland should start the day with a healthy, nutritious breakfast. And if we can start that conversation by having everybody bite an apple on the same day, frankly, everyone should start the day with a healthy, nutritious breakfast. But if we can focus on kids as part of that, that would be a good thing. And I think it's an opportunity for us to get those same athletes, whether it's Adam Jones or Michael Phelps or the women's lacrosse team at a local college, because we want this to be men and women doing this, would be a good thing.
Much more thoughts and panel about this. I mean, I think they do have a role to play. Go ahead.
Yes, they do have a role to play. Unfortunately, I don't know whether or not they've actually been approached and whether or not the culture within, let's say, the athletic industry understands their responsibility to give back to those communities and to really understand that they're actually helping to preserve their, so I say, customer base or fan base by helping people do better.
It would be another opportunity to point out some of these, shall we say, idiosyncrasies. Coke markets itself that it can be part of a healthy lifestyle, and by having these professional athletes market these drinks and all of these sugary drinks, it promotes that message, contrary to what all the evidence says in the scientific research. Some of these in the industry, like Coca-Cola, have partnered with the First Lady in the Drink Up program to promote drinking more water, you know, which is the world's easiest diet, right? It's cheap, it's accessible, it's free, we need it. But internally, they also have a program called Cap the Tap, which is for the restaurant industry, that incentivizes restaurants who don't put water out on the table unless people ask for it, who sell more of their product and push more of their product, and they get financial incentives. Those are things that would probably get the public moving. And then we can maybe get some of these, if we raise awareness among these athletic powerhouses, and we could turn the tide so that they could start representing the healthy.
Water used to be free.
Still is.
Now it's bottled.
Now it's bottled. Right. You have to pay for it. The changes are amazing. So I'm curious, what do we do in our personal lives to make this change? What do people in this audience do with our own lives, with our own homes, our own kids, the neighbors' kids, gatherings when you bring your children together, parties? What happens? What do you all do?
I would say that it is very difficult as a parent to tell your kid that they can't have sugar. And I find almost everywhere I turn, not only in my own family, but, you know, that's the easiest reward for kids to get. You know, when you want them to do something, you know, they get the sugar, it's like that. And you're not doing them justice over the long term at all. You're hurting them. But it's the easiest thing in the immediate moment, you know, and I see other side effects in terms of cavities and things because I'm in the dental arena, and, you know, trying to educate parents and tell them about how it affects their health overall and all these things, it's a real challenge. And that actually brings up a point about the faith-based, you know, movement involved in this, is that you have the community leaders can help to educate parents, because it's one thing to have, you know, these healthy choices available. It's another thing to have the parents get past that stumbling block of the child fighting them every step of the way because they want that sugar fix, you know, and then how does a parent And how do they help to manage that child? And I think the faith-based, the community leadership is a great kind of network for parents to learn parenting, because I think so many parents can't parent or don't parent as effectively as they could. And I think that could be a good arena too. And that, I think it's an important component in addition to the political movements and educational health stuff, you know.
That was Michael J. Wilson, Executive Director of Maryland Hunger Solutions. You also heard Dr. Serena Jordan, who conducts wellness classes at Huber Memorial Church and author of The Seven Disciplines of Wellness. Abby Zuckerberg, who organized the Faith Garden and Compost Project at Netivot Shalom Congregation. And Robbie Rawl, who is Executive Director of Sugar Free Kids, that encourages the community and policy change to engage in political actions that improve the health of our children. If you have thoughts about what you heard on today's show, write us at steinershow@gmail.com. Please also visit the brand new soundbitesradio.org website to hear today's program and podcast our past shows. Thanks for listening. Have a great day. The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites are a production of the Center for Emerging Media and made possible in part by a grant from the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer at WEAA is Andre Melton. Our engineer at Public Radio Delmarva is Christopher Rank. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, and find out information from the interviews we are doing on this program, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. You can also listen to and download our podcasts on iTunes. For Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and for WSDL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM, Delmarva Public Radio, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.